KCD News. I'm Dave McGrath. It's 10 past 8. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
Welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. On today's program, we're going to be talking about the foster care system here in America, what it seeks to do in terms of safeguarding young people and their well-being, and the many ways in which the foster care system, often because of the way it is designed, fails to deliver on that promise, and actually in some cases causes harm. My guest, Claudia Rowe, has written a fascinating book called Wards of the State, The Long Shadow of American Foster Care. Claudia Rowe began many years ago wanting to cover criminal activity as a reporter and journalist, fascinated by the whole question of why people do what they do, what motivates people, especially what motivates people to make bad choices, and how they see themselves and those bad choices. An editor suggested that she should look at public schools to get an idea of what was going on that was forming certain young minds to go on to commit crimes, to engage in criminal behavior. And that is what ultimately led her to examine not only the criminal justice system as it relates to young people, but also the foster care system and the intersection between the two. I began my conversation with Claudia Rowe by asking her about a quote from a middle school teacher who told her at one point, "Behavior is a language." In other words, when somebody is doing something, and especially when somebody is doing something they shouldn't be doing, that sometimes that is a way of conveying a message or communicating a message, whether consciously or unconsciously.
Yeah, I really believe that that's true. It was a teacher who I encountered while writing about school discipline and, you know, serious acts of violence that happen in schools. And she said, yes, behavior is a language. I believe that's true. I don't think that the person committing whatever act of violence is consciously trying to speak through their actions, but the action, you can interpret a lot of actions as a language trying to communicate things that the young person simply does not have the tools to speak, or we haven't listened well enough.
Right. And of course, this general interest ultimately took you to the world of foster care. And I guess maybe we could take a moment to just talk about this case of this young woman named Mary Ann, arrested for committing murder at the age of 16. And tell us about what initially drew you to her particular case and then what that ultimately led to in terms of this deeper exploration of the foster care system.
Thanks. Yeah, I had heard about Mary Ann's arrest, you know, at the time when she was arrested in 2016. I was at that point sort of deeply involved with education reporting. And, you know, her case, of course, sort of flashed across my radar because I was in the newsroom and I had a long interest in juvenile justice. So I knew about her case, but I wasn't reporting on it. I was focused on other things. I ended up attending the sentencing for her conviction. She was convicted of murder in the second degree. She finally pled guilty to second degree murder. I was at her sentencing for an entirely different reason. I was somewhat interested in the work of a forensic psychologist who is maybe going to be called to testify as to what he thought her punishment should be, what he thought was a just sentence. I was moderately interested in his work and was considering writing about it. So that's why I was there. In fact, he was never called, and the sentencing, which was supposed to be a two-hour hearing on one day, ended up extending over 3 days. And by the end of it, I realized a lot more about Marianne's case, and I also realized, oh wow, this is way beyond just a crime story. This is, in fact, a story about foster care. And her defense, is the reason this all sort of gelled for me. Her defense was attempting to argue that the foster care system, a government system, was at least partly to blame, partly culpable for her actions. I was very intrigued by that argument, which was ultimately unsuccessful in court, but it stuck in my mind, and it sort of propelled me toward looking at the overlap of kids in foster care and kids in the carceral system, kids who end up in the legal system. What was that overlap? How common was Marianne? I found out she was extremely common. Not that every foster kid is going to shoot someone in the head. Not at all. But an enormous number of foster kids do end up in the criminal justice system and do end up locked up. And I had not fully appreciated the depth of that overlap before Marianne.
And just to be clear, you are very careful, you and others, to not jump to conclusions about, because this person was in foster care, this is why they ended up committing these criminal acts. That you are, in fact, talking about trying to figure out, would this given young person have already ended up committing crimes had they never gone into foster care, or did going into foster care somehow contribute to that likelihood?
Right. It's a, you know, obviously it's you know, technically an impossible thing to know. However, there is real data, real scientists trying, there are real scientists trying to parse that question. And I came across one of them. He's an economist at MIT, Joseph Doyle. And in the early 2000s, he did this pioneering study that attempted to answer exactly that question. And he found that young people in foster care were three times more likely to end up locked up than those in sort of similar backgrounds and similar families, similar demographics, but who did not go into foster care. And his study was extremely intriguing to me. And then, in fact, it was a study that was partly out of Wisconsin that also sort of crystallized my thinking. Again, in the early 2000s, when I was sort of beginning to sort of perceive this connection, and there's a study out of Chapin Hall, which you probably know about, which is it's called the Midwest Evaluations, and it looked at young people aging out of foster care in Wisconsin, Iowa, and Illinois. And it found that by the time they were 26 years old, more than half had experienced some kind of incarceration. Could have been juvenile detention during foster care while they were still a minor, or county jail right after leaving the system, or state prison. But I think it was 59%, in fact, which is an incredibly high number. By age 26, this is a system that's supposed to be saving kids, but 59% end up locked up. This didn't add up to me. So, in fact, Wisconsin had a lot of sort of early formative, I don't know, a role in my early perception about this overlap.
It is such an important question, and obviously very much worth exploring. And that leads me to one of the important statements that you make early in the book, namely, foster care is in the midst of a historic reassessment. And so your book, in a sense, is both very well-timed and also probably to a large extent prompted by that fact, that we are, in a way, perhaps more than we ever have before, reassessing, rethinking how foster care works in our country. Tell us more about this moment of, again, what you call historic reassessment.
Okay. So foster care, as the system as it exists today, is not all that different from the system as it began, you know, 100, 125 years ago. We've been doing foster care for a bit over a century, and it's largely similar to what it was at the beginning. And in fact, this overlap of young people becoming either incarcerated or homeless almost immediately after leaving foster care has been the same for decades. This is what I was looking at in this book, was not some recent trend or sudden spike. This was, wow, this has been, you know, just waves of kids going into our carceral system or onto our streets as homeless for decades. And while people within the system are well aware, I didn't think that sort of like the general reader, general person not connected to foster care, I didn't think that the general reader or audience member was aware of this. And it really stunned me, the sort of pervasive effects of foster care within our society, say, you know, driving mass incarceration, or on our streets, you know, enormous number percentages of homeless folks were in the foster care system. And I, you know, those outcomes, those are the primary outcomes of foster care, serious damage. And advocates are well aware of it. And for that reason, they have been pushing more and more toward abolition. So this is what I mean by a historic reassessment. There's a growing movement to abolish foster care, to get rid of it because of these atrocious outcomes. And, you know, as we know, advocates often push a conversation. And while it is certainly true that there are kids who cannot live safely at home, that is true. We need to do something for them. It is also true that this country has ushered many more children into foster care than perhaps needed to be there. And that is what the abolitionists are saying, that far too many children of color, and all of them poor. I mean, there are no middle-class kids who go into foster care. Infinitesimal, very few. It's all poor children. So
you tell us that is a long story, which we'll explore in a moment, but there is a long historical precedent for the removal of children from poor families, from poor homes, that is, economically poor homes. And
correct.
That is...
Right. And when you see the outcomes, you can understand why people say, well, why are we, this system is crazy. We spend $30 billion every year, $30 billion on foster care, and those are the outcomes? That's what we're paying for? This seems crazy. This is not what we want. And so that's why there is this reassessment happening.
Right. And we should add that you take care in your book to point out that we should not sort of lunge at simplistic assumptions about how the main problem here is with poor foster parents. I mean, that is foster parents doing a poor job. Now I'm using the word poor in a different way. But I mean, that there are certainly cases of that, of people who probably should not be foster parents who are doing terrible things to their foster children, or at the very least not serving them all that well. But that's not really, as far as you're concerned, the primary problem here. It is not so much the people in the foster care system. It is the system itself, the way it is set up, that is leading to the greatest harm. Or at least, I believe you say that pretty straightforwardly.
Absolutely. That is absolutely what I think, and I appreciate your perceiving that. It isn't that there are... Of course there are abusers in the foster care system. I've written about them. We write these horrific stories. We do. We write these stories about horrible people who abuse their foster children. But that is not what foster care is, and that is not what's going on here. That is not the main thing. There is no villain, no person who's a villain. It is the system, the way it is structured. Foster care is all about... It's about impermanence, right? It's about kids moving from one home to another until they are either reunited with their biological family or adopted. You know, so the system says it's geared toward permanence. But the reality of the system is impermanence. It's kids moving from home to home, instability, and never and traditionally being discouraged from forming bonds with any particular caretaker or social worker. Social workers change on a dime, or a child might be, you know, might be at school and a social worker pulls up and all their clothes are, all the kids' clothes are in the back of the car, and they're like, yeah, you're not going to Mrs. Jones tonight, you're going to a new home. That is exactly what happened to Mary Ann. It happens to, you know, thousands of kids. They are just moved without warning, without any kind of warm-up or handoff or anything. That instability and that sort of sundering of connection or bonds to any stable, ongoing adult presence, that has profound effects on a developing brain, on a young person's growing consciousness and actual their brain chemistry. And that is what's going on. That is why so many kids leave the system, you know, poorly prepared for a fulfilling adult life, unable to this thing about sundered bonds has profound repercussions in adult life. And I don't mean just like, oh, you have trouble sustaining a romantic relationship. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about dealing with employers, dealing with sort of the challenges of life, the frustrations that we all weather every day, insults, humiliation, boredom, impatience, all the things that all of us have to deal with, you know, every day. For many, many young people who come out of the foster care system, they do not have sort of the internal resources often to weather those challenges. And that is because of this sort of early attachment rupture, I think. And there's a lot of science in the book. Not too much. It's not heavy, but there are brain, you know, there is brain science in the book, and it speaks to that. The U.S. government has said it, too. This isn't some wild theory I concocted. The National Academies of Science has said the same thing.
Absolutely. And, of course, many people speak eloquently on behalf of this observation. One of them, a former child in the foster care system, Arthur Longsworth, whom we'll talk about a little bit later. At one point, you quote him as saying that it is almost an inescapable element of experience in the foster care system, this lack of anything to hold onto. You have no stability in anything. As far as anyone knows, you're nobody from nowhere. And he uses terms like powerlessness and worthlessness to describe what is sort of at the heart of the emotional lives of way too many young people who are part of the foster care system.
Yeah, Art is an incredible writer. So Art was important for me because what I wanted to do in Wards of the State was two things. I wanted to explain this experience through the eyes of the young people living it. Then I also, of course, had to provide the kind of connective tissue that explained why they were in such a situation to begin with. So it's sort of operating on two tracks, through the kids' eyes and then sort of through my lens as the journalist narrator explaining sort of the framework of the system around them. Art was essential for the book because what I wanted was, in this effort to articulate through the young person's eyes, you know, Art was a middle-aged man when he wrote the words that you just quoted, but he was still able to touch that young person's emotional reality. And yet, because he's a skilled and talented writer, he's able to articulate it in a way that a person who is 14 or 16 is unlikely to be able to do. I couldn't have written that when I was 16. Art probably couldn't have either. But now, as a middle-aged man, he was able to sort of look back and touch that experience and write it. It's an essential bridge for me in that sense.
We're speaking with Claudia Rowe about her remarkable new book called Wards of the State, The Long Shadow of American Foster Care. One of the things I appreciate about your book is that you give us kind of a long-term historical view of, in a sense, how we got here. And at one point you say, the question of what to do with indigent kids has confounded authorities since colonial times. And indeed, it really is kind of interesting to think about what we sort of immediately imagine as the typical sort of foster care situation in the present day, and the circumstances under which a child might be removed from their parents' home, versus that happening 50 years ago or 100 years ago or 200 years ago. But that has been happening for quite some time. And the means by which this has been addressed has changed a bit over time. I suspect that this was probably a really intriguing part of your study and research on this topic, was to take a look back at, for instance, the mid-19th century, where we can sort of trace the beginning of much of this.
Right. It fascinated me, and I was really fascinated to see and discover, again, how early this kind of overlap between seeing, you know, our concern for kids in need and our fear of these very same kids. And I'm not talking about my fear specifically, but our country's sort of, how do I say it, sort of a vacillating, it's the same kids that we are both fearful of and kind of wanting to control, but also wanting to care for. It's a very sort of shimmering, shifting light on the same child. And this has been from the beginning. In the historical section of the book that you're alluding to, I discovered, you know, an early sort of a kid who was part of this effort out of New York City that we now sometimes refer to as the orphan train movement. That it wasn't called that at the time, but it started in the late 19th century. And the idea was, it was actually a minister, Charles Loring Brace, who eventually founded the Children's Aid Society. But he was seeing all these indigent kids on the streets of New York City. This is mostly Italian and Irish immigrant children, destitute, living on the street, sort of banding together for survival. And his idea was, well, we have this sort of new country with these farms out west and people out in the west who are trying to till the land, and why don't we round up all these kids and send them out west, and they'll be out of the mean streets of the evil city, and they'll be out in the sort of healthy country, and they'll be able to help the farmers, and it's a win for everyone. Right. It's also, you know, forced labor, all kinds of other things that, you know, are less salubrious. But that was sort of what became foster care. And one of those early kids on those trains out west ended up being the first person executed in the brand new state of Wyoming. He was 17 years old. He had killed two guys on a boxcar because he was starving and alone, and you know, he had been sort of kicked out of his foster home, which was exactly what happened to Art Longworth. And he ended up killing two men and ended up being executed for it. And again, this was a sort of an early encapsulation of, you know, people. This was the early progressive era. People came out saying, oh, this poor boy, Charlie, you know, he was all alone. And then there were other people who were, you know, hang 'em high. Exactly like what we have today, this sort of split in sort of welling compassion and paired with a kind of intense punitive impulse.
When you describe the move towards something more tightly wed to the U.S. government and the foster care system which we now have, it sounds like one of the really crucial years was 1961, when some changes were made, you know, in terms of kind of how the system would operate and under what guidelines. And you tell us that in the wake of this, the foster care system seems to have kind of ballooned in size. Tell us more about this moment in the history of the foster care system.
So initially, there had been efforts in the early part of the 20th century to this idea of the government supporting what were at the time widows, white widows, I need to emphasize here, sort of whose husbands had gone off to war, or who were widowed for whatever reason. And this early government idea about support for widows. So that was happening, widows who had children, obviously. That was happening at the early part of the 20th century. And then increasingly, that government money was going toward black women who were without husbands but who had children. Eventually, southern states started making stipulations about who could get this government support and who couldn't, and it was pretty clearly aimed to cut out black women from getting that government support. The government sort of chimed in on a national level in 1961 and was essentially saying, if a home is so troubled, that child shouldn't be in the home, and we should take that child out of the home. That is when the government shifted from sort of sending money to troubled homes to removing children from troubled homes and paying strangers essentially to care for them. And at that point, the system shifted from sort of supporting white families in trouble to fracturing thousands of black families. And that is, you know, an important pivot and inheritance of the system that we have today.
As I said at the outset, much of your book is about the lives of some individuals, that is, some young people, and in at least one case, someone who's not so young anymore, but also a product of the foster care system, if you will. But following these specific individual stories in some detail. And I appreciate the fact that you make that choice, because I think it would be a very different book if you were simply speaking in generalities. I wonder how much you thought about the way in which this book is constructed, with certain individual stories very much in the foreground. And I'm also curious to know how carefully you selected this roughly half dozen individual stories, that they should be the ones that are given this particular attention. I guess another question, a way to ask the question, is what do those individual stories, in a sense, kind of collectively represent?
So in the research about this connection between youth in foster care and youth in the justice system, I identified four sort of events that happen in foster care that were common to every kid in foster care who ended up either locked up or homeless. And I'm not saying I interviewed every kid in the U.S., but of the dozens of young people I did interview and all the research I read that, you know, spanned decades, what I could identify, these sort of threads pulled out of it. And there were four experiences that were standard in foster care and common to young people who ended up in the legal system. And they were running away from a placement, which is incredibly common, group homes, failed adoptions or broken adoptions, that is, kids adopted from the foster system who are then returned to it by their adoptive parents, kicked out. This is very undercovered, and it is devastating. And the fourth thing is aging out at 18 without support. So these four things seemed to be like choke points or where we could identify what was going to happen, likely to happen with a young person. Then I wanted people, real people, not composites, like real people who could sort of explain that, tell that story, illuminate that phenomenon of these four sort of prongs in foster care that led to these outcomes that are so troubling. That was number one. I needed people who could speak to these experiences, and I wanted some geographical breadth. I live in Washington State. I didn't want this to just be written off as, oh, it's a Washington State problem, it's a Washington State book. It's not. It's national. I also really wanted this breadth of generations, of time. Arthur Longworth is the oldest person in the book, and he is 60 this year. That is why the subtitle is The Long Shadow of Foster Care, because it's not as if, even for kids who don't end up locked up or homeless, it's not as if you go through foster care and you exit into some shining life and it's all in the past and it has no hold over your adult existence. It's not that way at all. It's, in fact, a shadow over people's lives. There are some folks in the book who have gone on to incredible success, have become activists at the White House and lawyers at operating at very high levels. It's a shadow over their lives, too. So that is how I chose people, who could represent a breadth of geographies and races and ages, and who could articulate or illuminate these four experiences common to lockup or homelessness.
Hmm. I want to ask you about one specific matter related to Monique Thompson. And as you are telling the story of her life and what she experienced, what she lost, what she gained, her struggles, you say at one point, and I hope I'm reading this correctly, I can scarcely read my scribbled handwriting, but you, I think, say something to this effect. The most painful part of Monique's story was her desperation to bond with her foster families and her compulsive sabotaging of those connections, each and every one. I just thought that was heartbreaking to read, that somebody, through no conscious fault of their own, was somehow undermining the very thing that they wanted more than anything else. I wonder if you could talk a little more about that, about, at least in Monique's case, where was that coming from, and what is it that can be done about that?
That's a really trenchant question, really incisive, and I appreciate you bringing up Monique's story, because in many ways I find her story to be the most painful and difficult in the book. Monique is one of the few kids, comparatively few, who was removed from her home for suspected sexual abuse. One would think that that would be a huge driver of kids entering foster care. In fact, it is not. It is one of the lower reasons that kids enter foster care. Monique was removed from her home at age 5 because of suspected sexual abuse by her stepfather. She moved through so many foster homes. The decision about what had really happened to her was inconclusive, but her behavior spoke volumes, right? While medical science couldn't determine what was, absolutely pinpoint for definitively what had happened to her, her behavior as a 6-year-old, a 7-year-old, indicated clearly something had gone wrong at home. And it is that behavior that you're speaking to. Many, many foster parents wanted to take Monique in. Several talked about adopting her. But when a new foster child would come into that home where Monique was living, she would flip out of sort of jealousy or competitiveness or really insecurity, desperate for a family, but unable, because she is a young child, to control her impulses and contain her emotions. She's just living through her emotions. She's 7, 8, 10. She is a child who very likely was sexually abused. And the one problem with the foster care system is it's kind of a way station. It's not really a system built to heal children. Yes, they get therapy, and often it's, psychotropic drugs. But really, the system is not built to heal severely damaged kids. But severely damaged kids are who is in the system. So that's really what happened to Monique. She had clearly had something go way off the rails at an early age at home. her foster parents, the many of them, were entirely well-intended, wanted to care for her. But this is a girl who is, you know, kicking out the railings of a banister when a new girl comes into the house because she's worried that the new girl is prettier. Her foster mom will like the new girl better. I mean, really, really, like, childlike fears. But nobody could really speak to the depth of the damage, the hurt in her. And as she grew older, her behaviors became more and more difficult to contain, right? She's getting bigger. She's physically lashing out. And, of course, she eventually ends up in juvenile detention. Very briefly, I should add, she wasn't convicted of any kind of serious crime. She was there for lashing out. This is really common. She's not some sort of hardened criminal in any way. She's a seriously hurt young woman, not so young anymore, in her 20s, who the system attempted to help but really couldn't help. And that's a profound fact that we have to grapple with.
Right. At one point, you quote the top child welfare official in the state of Washington describing the foster care system as a poison like chemotherapy, a cure that damaged the body anew. And of course, chemotherapy is not administered to cause harm. It's to try to deal with a desperate life and death situation. But in the treatment, it also causes harm and hurt and different kinds of misery. And in a sense, that is the observation when the foster care system, especially at those points when it is beleaguered, overwhelmed, is very unlikely to deliver what it promises in any kind of effective way. Could we take a couple minutes to talk about something especially sad, and we've touched on it once or twice already, and that is this phenomenon of broken adoptions, which you mention as one of the kind of red flags that often is an indication that a young person who has experienced something so sad is perhaps more likely to get into even more serious trouble down the road. Were you able to determine what tends to be at the heart of these broken adoptions when an adoptive family turns a young person back into the public, so to speak?
I think in general, I think there are two things. States have financial incentives to push adoption, right? It's, as I said at the beginning of our talk, the effort toward permanence, reunite with your biological family or get adopted. These are the two sort of goals of foster care. And for that reason, states get financial bonuses for kids who they adopt. So, not surprisingly, kids who are adopted out. Not surprisingly, they're going to push it. They're going to rush it. And many, many adoptive parents are simply not prepared for the realities and the intensity of some of the behaviors that will come with a kid who has been through foster care and whatever brought them into foster care to begin with, right? So every kid in foster care, by definition, has endured some kind of trauma. It could be the trauma of a parent dying, you know, it doesn't have to be that they were, you know, beaten, but some kind of trauma has put that kid in foster care. The system itself has likely not healed them, and so they come to an adoptive family with, you know, an incredible backlog, an incredible case file of damage. And many foster families don't have access to the full case file and are kind of rushed into adopting and have fairly minimal support after they've adopted. I mean, sure, there's a social worker who will check in, yes, but the reality of these behaviors is sometimes more than what an adoptive family is often more than what an adoptive family is prepared to grapple with and to navigate and to handle.
Well, I'm sure many adoptive parents enter into these moments with the highest of expectations, as do, I'm sure, those young people being adopted. And reality almost always ends up being far more complicated and far more difficult than anyone on either side of this arrangement could possibly imagine.
Which is profoundly sad. Monique was desperate to be adopted. So was Marianne. And in fact, she was adopted. But as soon, you know, there was a brief sort of honeymoon period where they're all like horseback riding and whitewater rafting, and it's just fantastic. But the truth is that many, many children in foster care have not been raised in what, in like a traditional family environment. So, for instance, in Marianne's case, she was sort of dumbfounded and perplexed by family dinners, right? She did not feel comfortable sitting at a table and sort of being like, ooh, insta-family, pretend, you know, here you are, now you're our daughter. You know, she was really uncomfortable. She felt phony. And I think she felt sort of awkward or guilty in the face of the expectation of her new foster parents. But she is 12 years old, and she cannot articulate those feelings in any kind of, you know, thoughtful manner. And so what does she do? She lashes out, she kicks doors, she hoards food in her room. She does all kinds of things that eventually terrify her adoptive family so much that they ask the state to take her back. Hmm. That act, even though Marianne acted like she hated them, and maybe she did hate them, right? I mean, whatever it was
particularly in the moment.
Right, particularly in the moment, like any teenager. By this point, you know, she's 14 years old, right? She's a teenager with all the sort of emotionality and rage that is in any teenager, but add on top of that her foster care and early experience before foster care. She simply could not handle being in this family. Despite that, the rejection and the sort of being sent back to foster care was a rejection so profound that a psychologist who testified at her case said, you know, it had a pivotal, formative effect on her behavior later, which involved shooting a man in the head. Mm-hmm. You can't pinpoint one thing, but it did strike me when that psychologist testified at her sentencing about the sort of profound effect of that rejection, of being thrown back to foster care. Marianne told me from prison that she had no idea you could be unadopted. And I didn't know, right? Mm-hmm. I don't think most of us realize that, yeah, you can be unadopted. And it can happen fast.
Right.
Or it can happen over years.
And you call it one of foster care's saddest secrets. I'm haunted by the quote of one of the other young people you talk to in your book, who says, in terms of his own really sad situation, please let all this pain mean something. And this particular young man goes on to a fine life in which he is working within the system to try to make it better. In our last couple of minutes, you tell us that one of the most promising pathways of reform involve trying to shift the foster care system to a system that builds bonds rather than simply interrupts them. Is there hope that such a system can be created?
Yes, and I'm so glad you have asked about that. So the young man that you just referred to, his name is Sixto Cancel. He also endured a broken adoption, and he did go on to become who he is today, which is this sort of national-level activist focused on improving foster care. And Sixto's main drive, which is happening nationally increasingly, is something called kinship care, which is to get the foster care system to shift toward looking first to relatives, to kin. It could also be what they call fictive kin, like a family friend or a teacher or a coach, someone who knows the child, someone who is connected to the child's world and community and growing up, rather than a stranger. Shockingly, that is new and was traditionally discouraged. The traditional idea that has been pervasive throughout almost all of, you know, sort of modern foster care history is, oh, if your family is, you know, bad, we want to obliterate that from your consciousness. We want to sever that bad past and send you to a new life where you have no memory and no connection of the past, which is just absurd. That is not how human beings operate. Those bonds exist. And as we've said, the sundering of bonds is part of the damage here. So Sixto's sort of push is to get government support for kin, because, you know, many sort of grandparents and aunts and uncles have taken in the children of, you know, their grandchildren or their nieces or nephews, but they never get, they traditionally didn't get any kind of government support for that. So you have a grandma taking care of her two grandkids because her own daughter can't do it, and that, and grandma is, you know, is bankrupting her retirement savings to care for children who she never planned to be parenting at age 75. That was the case, you know, 20 years ago when I was sort of beginning to write about that phenomenon. Now, because of activists like Sixto and many others, nationally, more and more kin are able to be licensed just for their own, you know, relative foster placements, you know, their grandchild or nephew or whomever it might be, rather than going through the elaborate hoops that you have to jump through to be licensed as a foster parent for any child. So emergency licensing of kin for government support is a relatively newer effort, and it certainly will mitigate some of the harm of just plunking children into strangers' homes, which is what we've been doing for decades. That's one thing. Another effort to address sort of the same thing, it comes at the other end, and it's called QPI, Quality Parenting Initiative. This is an effort out of a youth legal advocacy group in California, but it has been adopted in maybe 10 states. It's trying to do the same thing, which is work on bonds and attachment. In this case, it is working on bonds between the foster parent and child, and the foster parent and the biological family. Again, something that has been traditionally discouraged and is difficult to navigate. But the idea, like Florida, for instance, passed a law saying early on, the first night, the first week, the foster parent and biological parent must have a conversation by phone so that the child in this new stranger's home, you know, so that the new foster parent knows what they like to eat, you know, what TV shows they like, something to show the child that, you know, people are seeing you. People know your real family, and they care about your biological family. Like, this is a network of people who've got you, rather than just some anonymous handoff, and you're just this kid wandering around. Hmm. Again, QPI, working on the same thing from a different angle. More efforts to address the fact that this phenomenon of attachment is foundational. It affects people's psychology through their lives, and we must address it in foster care because the system is oriented toward severing those attachments. Mm.
The book again is titled Wards of the State, The Long Shadow of American Foster Care, published by Abrams Press, the author Claudia Rowe. Claudia Rowe, thank you for writing this incredibly important book, and thank you for being such an articulate spokesman on behalf of this really important concern. Thank you so much, and thank you for being my morning show guest today.
Thanks for having me on. May I say one last point?
Yes.
I want to hit for your listeners.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's important to say that every kid in this book, and I say kid, even though many of them are adults now, you know, whatever their twisted paths or sadness or questionable choices, which we might, you know, debate, every one of them spoke to me because they wanted to make the system better for the kids coming up behind them. And, you know, many people will demonize a person, of course, for committing crimes. And many of the kids in this book have committed crimes. But I think it's important to say they are thinking about the kids behind them. And that strikes me as, I don't know, surprisingly hopeful.
Right. That's a very powerful statement in and of itself. Claudia Rowe, author of Wards of the State, thank you again.
Thank you so much, Greg.
The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. Today we have ahead of us widespread early morning fog giving way to partly sunny skies and a high temperature today of 76 degrees cooler near the lake. Partly cloudy overnight, patchy fog, low of 56. Tomorrow, partly sunny, but with a 40% chance of rain, high of 83. This is WG.